This is Psych Talk, and I'm Jose Dras Lopez.
You're listening to Psych Talk.
On this hour, we are asking, why do teenagers do stupid things? What makes them different from children or adults? And how can parents and the rest of society help teenagers to develop into healthy adults? Our two expert guests are here to answer all that and more. Dr. Scott Swartzwelder is a neuropsychologist at Duke University who studies how alcohol and other drugs interact with the brain, particularly in adolescence. He has published over 130 scientific papers, written 4 books for a general audience, and trained more than 50 scientists and clinicians. Our second guest is Dr. Aaron White. He is a biological psychologist focused on the effects of alcohol and other drugs on the adolescent brain. He works on adolescent substance abuse treatment and prevention initiatives. He is part of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, where he oversees publicly funded studies on college and underage drinking prevention. Both Dr. Swartzwelder and Dr. White are prolific lecturers and educators, and they work together to create Alcohol EDU, an online alcohol education course that has been completed by more than 2 million students. Their latest book is What Are They Thinking? The Straight Facts About the Risk-Taking, Social Networking, Still Developing Teen Brain. Thank you both so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure.
Why don't we do it this way, since we've got 3 voices and 2 on the phones. Why don't you both just introduce yourselves so our listeners can get used to who's who. So, Aaron, why don't you start?
Sure. My name is Aaron White. As Jose mentioned, I am a psychologist trained in brain research, and I'm very interested in how the brain develops during the teen years and how various environments and experiences can influence that development in positive and negative ways.
Fantastic. And Scott? Scott, you with us? Looks like we might have lost Scott. So what we'll do, Aaron, is I'm going to start off with a couple questions with you. We're going to patch in a little music and reset the call. How does that sound?
Sure.
I wanted to talk about what adolescence is or what it means to be a teenager and sort of what sets it apart from being a child or adult.
Sure. Well, until recently, the general assumption was that by the time we hit about the age of 10, most of the changes that take place in the brain are done, and that during the teenage years, we behave the way we do primarily because of changes in hormone levels, not because of any changes in the wiring or functioning of the brain. And what we've learned in the last 20 years has turned that all upside down, and we now know that quite a bit of adolescent behavior can be explained by the changes that are taking place in the brain. And further, the brain is built to be molded with ease during these years. And so it's critical that we do what we can to help mold these brains in healthy ways so that once our kids reach adulthood, they can use those brains to thrive and be good citizens and all of those things. We used to think that adolescence was sort of a new concept. A lot of people still believe that, well, adolescence is something new. You know, it's a luxury of a modern society, a luxury of capitalism, and it's actually not true. In nature, puberty and adolescence usually run together, meaning puberty is the physiological changes that prepare us to be able to have children and protect them. So it's the physical changes, the sexual development that we see on the surface. Adolescence is the molding of the individual to learn how to function and survive in the world as it is now, to use those changes of puberty to thrive in the world. And until recently, they ran so closely together, they were indistinguishable. The body starts changing, you start socializing and learning how to function in the world, take on adult roles. You become sexually mature at about 18. You become able to take on young adult responsibilities by the age of about 18. And so they sort of ran together. But in the modern world, they actually separate. And puberty is starting earlier. Adolescence is ending later, so it's protracted. So that's what's happening, and the behaviors, as we'll discuss, I'm sure, that we tend to see during the adolescent years facilitate that process of transition, the transition from being dependent on adults to being able to function on our own and be adults.
Right. Well, there's some really fascinating material there to work off of. Just that point, first of all, separating puberty and adolescence, and then thinking about how it crosses cultures and has always been there historically, rather than being some sort of new fad. All very interesting to talk about. One follow-up I have to that before we cut to a break and bring in our second guest is there's this sense that some neuroscientists have when they're talking to the public that the teens are missing a part of the brain that adults have. That there's just, I've even seen a funny advertisement that shows a car-shaped hole in the front of a teen's brain saying, well, this is why you need extra insurance for your teen driving. Tell us what's really in the brain in terms of lack of maturity or missing pieces that makes teens different.
Sure. You know, as I mentioned, it's only been about actually less than 20 years since the discovery was made that there were these changes occurring in the teen brain. It was discovered really by accident by researchers here at NIH. And the first part of the brain that was discovered to be changing considerably during the teen years were the frontal lobes. And the frontal lobes, which are located right behind the forehead, are the structures in the brain that let us do what we do as humans. The frontal lobes let us think about the future, make plans for the future, make decisions that guide ourselves toward the future. And very importantly, the frontal lobes let us control urges to do things that could disrupt our objectives for the future. And so the frontal lobes really are what allow us to do things that are different than what your household pets can do. You know, we can project ourselves into the future and guide ourselves there by using our frontal lobes to make decisions and control our urges. And it turns out the frontal lobes are truly being remodeled during the adolescent years. You know, during the second decade of life, there's this widespread sculpting of the frontal lobes to allow us to learn how to do those things in the world. I mean, the rules of how to function in the world are a little different with each generation. So each generation of kids has to learn how to survive in the current society. And so I think early on in this new area of research, the assumption became, oh, well, not only is the brain changing during the teen years, but the frontal lobes are really not fully developed. Therefore, this must be why teens make such bad choices. They can't think about the future. They have trouble controlling their urges. So that often people will suggest the frontal lobes aren't online yet, therefore teens can't do the things adults can do with regard to planning and thinking and decision-making. That is certainly part of the puzzle, but it turns out that there are areas in the brain that govern our emotional reactions to things that are highly active during the teen years. So it seems to be the combination of strong emotional drive. You know, think Romeo and Juliet. It wasn't just bad decision-making. You know, there was intense emotion involved there. Teens are capable of incredibly intense, tumultuous feelings. So it's the combination of the emotional drive and the frontal lobes not being fully online that compel us as teens to often make poor choices. It's simply just not the case that it's just one area of the brain isn't working right. You know, that alone can't explain teen behavior.
Right. If only it were that simple.
Right. The book we just wrote would be 10 pages if it were that simple.
Right. All right. So very interesting stuff there. And I mean, one point you emphasize now that you also emphasize in your book is that part of what makes us unique as humans is the malleability we have both as babies and then as teenagers in adapting to whatever world we're born into and then applying our intelligence to it. And so that part of the changes happening in the teen brain have to do with that malleability, right? It'll be interesting to talk about what happens that can shape teen brains in a good way or a bad way. But what we're going to do right now is cut to a little bit of music, and we'll try to rejig the call a bit, and we'll be back online soon. This is Psych Talk. Stay tuned.
If I could call back.
We're back on Psych Talk. As we said at the top of the hour, we're talking about teenagers, why they do stupid things, why adolescence is a malleable time. And we've got two guests with us, Dr. Scott Swartzwelder and Dr. Aaron White. Now, Aaron and Scott, I'm going to cross my fingers. Are you both on the line?
Yes, I am.
Yep. Scott's here.
All right. Hallelujah. All right. The technology gods are not kind to us today. But Scott, why don't you tell us a little bit more about some of the sculpting that happens in the frontal lobes during adolescence, including, you know, white and gray matter changes?
You know, the very beginnings of adolescence, which is when puberty occurs, is probably what kicks off some of these brain changes. And what you get then early in the process is a proliferation of gray matter, that is the cell body, which is really measured as the cell bodies themselves, as opposed to the processes or the little tendrils that come off of those cells and receive and transfer information. But the gray matter begins to decrease across adolescence and into early adulthood, while what's happening with the message receiving parts of the cell is that those are actually being sculpted into their final configuration. And so it's since what neurons do is really communicate with one another, and so it is those parts of the cells that are doing the receiving and integrating of information, those areas that are getting sculpted through that adolescent process, that are really the most important elements of the cells in terms of how they're going to function going forward. And since they are located in the frontal lobes, and those regions are so important for endowing us with a lot of the skills that you need to survive in the adult world, it's a critically important developmental time.
Fantastic. On this point about adolescence, I was reading the book, and I'm also hearing you describe how actually gray matter decreases after around 10 to 12 in childhood, and that the gray matter is these cell bodies sort of in the middle of these neurons. So I'm wondering, is it actually that cells are being killed off, or how does that work?
Well, it really is kind of a dying off process, and it's just a use it or lose it kind of phenomenon. More cells are generated than are actually needed, and one of the things that people often misunderstand about the brain is that more is not necessarily better. What you want is efficiency. And so as you lose some of that gray matter, you're actually increasing efficiency. People just think about the brain of, oh, you lose cells, you have a deficit, you gain cells, you know, you have an advantage. It doesn't necessarily go that way, and this developmental process is a good reflection of that.
Right. You know what? I was just reminded of that myth that we only use 10% of our brains, which is not true, but I might as well try to tackle some corollary that might pop to mind. Do teenagers somehow use less of their brains than adults do? And Scott, you can answer that.
No. I mean, there's no good evidence for that. Teenagers use their brains differently. They have different, you know, ratios of gray matter to white matter and so forth. But they don't use it. They don't use any less of it. And as you say, it is just an old myth that we only use a small proportion of our brain. In fact, every cell in the brain is active at every second, if not necessarily firing and communicating specific messages to another cell. They're at least active in maintaining their readiness to do that. That takes an immense amount of energy. As far as we know so far, there's really no difference in that regard between the adolescent brain and the adult brain. But I would point out that this is all fairly new science. We're just scratching the tip of the iceberg about the differences between the adolescent and adult brain, and so you never know what we're going to find.
Well, if I could just add something to what Scott said, which I totally agree with, if anything, teens use the brain areas they have harder than adults do in order to accomplish tasks that once we're adults become pretty easy to do. If you look at a 10-year-old, while they perform a simple task that requires them to inhibit a response, you know, it's a very basic frontal lobe dependent task, and you compare that to a 20-year-old, what you see is that the frontal lobes of the 10-year-old light up more. It requires more energy across a more diffuse set of networks to perform this simple task than it does once we reach adulthood. Once we reach adulthood, you see fine-tuned, very focused, powerful activity restricted in a small area. And it's that pruning process that Scott described that gets you from diffuse activity, wasted energy, to highly focused, powerful activity, stronger performance, and all of that. So they certainly don't use less of the brain. And in fact, they may use what they have harder, you know, a little less efficiently than we do once we're adults.
That's a really fascinating point. I'm glad you added that. And it reminds me of your book's chapter on driving and how when a teen is learning to drive, or really anyone, but especially a teen, they're using a lot more of their brain's resources consciously to accomplish the task, whereas an adult can more efficiently go on autopilot, right?
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, there's that. And I should mention, since I mentioned there's one chapter, that there's an interesting facet of this book that it's sort of a survey of lots of different areas. So it's got chapters on food, sleep, driving, violence, mental health, the digital life for teens, and drugs. So we're only going to be able to tackle some chunks of those. One thing, it's a point you make at the beginning and end that's worth discussing from a parent's perspective, is that teenagers take big risks and they want to push away from the family. So what's the biological rationale for that? Either one of you, if you want to join together on that.
Well, I'll give the simple answer and give Scott some room to expound if he'd like. We just refer to it as swimming to the deep end of the gene pool. We have to get out of the home and go explore, learn how to survive in the outside world, but also meet people who are not related to us or closely related to us. It's critical that we do that. And none of this would happen if you turn, you know, 14 and all you want to do is hang out with your parents all day. And so it makes sense that we would want to push away and go find our own path and not do it with our parents or with our families. And so we think, you know, at the core is this this imperative for biological diversity, genetic diversity.
I agree with that, obviously, and I would just add that from a parent's standpoint, it's very important to understand that this is a natural process. And although teens may not be the greatest at articulating why they're trying to move away from the family, and sometimes that can be expressed as resentment or rebellion and interpreted by parents as disobedience and acting out, the fact of the matter is it's a very normal and natural process. Now, I would hesitate to add to that the fact that the adolescent brain is still developing and kids are motivated to move away from the family does not justify poor behavior, okay? It doesn't make it okay when kids do things that put themselves at risk. But it does give parents a lens through which to view those behavioral changes that might put them in a position to have a different kind of conversation, which is based a little bit more on fact and a little bit less on emotion. And that, we think, is a really valuable opportunity that the brain science, which is, you know, coming forward now, presents us with.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I agree. I got that feeling from reading the way you presented facts that it would help parents to take a more empathetic and less judgmental perspective towards the mistakes their teens do make, while still being able to say, you know, what you did is wrong, here are the rules, etc. Here's one area that I'd like to put you both on the spot on as parents yourselves. You're both parents of teens and preteens. I warned you I was going to ask about this. Have you had a chance to talk about sex with your kids? Because this is a chapter in your book, and I mean, reproduction is a big part of the biological imperative that's driving puberty. So I'm curious, you know, more from a parenting advice perspective, what's a template for what you tell your kids when you're informed by brain science?
Oh, well, I can start off maybe because my kids are older, and I went through it before Aaron. He's going through it now. To me, it was never really much of an issue, and part of that is just because of popular culture. I mean, in my generation, right, growing up in the 60s, I mean, sex was not as open a topic. I was not as exposed to that kind of information and misinformation as a child as my kids were. It's everywhere, right? It's on the internet. It's on television. It's everywhere. So the opportunities for communicating are there. I think the job of the parent and what my wife and I did raising our kids and addressing sex with them is, you know, we just had to look around for teachable moments, and they're everywhere. You know, the kid comes home from school with a story about, you know, somebody who did something or got in some trouble, or there's a TV show on and they make a sexual reference or a gender stereotype reference or something like that. parents of this, of our current generation, have the advantage that they sometimes view as a problem, but in fact, it's an advantage that information is out there. So instead of having to initiate the conversation, sometimes in that very awkward, uncomfortable, Ozzie and Harriet 1950s way, in fact, conversation's already going on. And as a parent, you just find opportunities to chime in what you think is important for the kids to focus on.
Right. Aaron, any thoughts on that? When you're braving the storm, are you as optimistic about using those teachable moments?
Oh, yeah. And I think you have to understand, Scott has been my mentor for 10 years now, so it's not much of a surprise that I'm sort of following his lead after watching him go through this with his kids. And my kids were just babies when I started working with him. So, my son is 13, and we've been having snippets of discussions about sex since he was a kid, since he was a baby, a toddler, just whenever the opportunity, when you're teaching a kid about potty training, you're actually talking to them about their, these organs, and so I think in a way the conversation starts even then, to some degree, and it just builds the foundation for further talks. We have not had any real deep discussions about, actual sex and life. You're going to edit this part out, right? This is not going out live. But we're almost there. But he's right where he can really start to understand it at a deeper level. So we'll be having these conversations soon.
I would add in one other thing too that Aaron reminds me of here, and that is, in a more global sense, the more you communicate with your kids when they're little, the easier those conversations are going to be when they're adolescents. Okay, so if you build up a relationship of trust and confidence, not that everything's all rosy all the time, but you convey that you're available and that you're going to be helping but not judging all the time. I think it really lays the groundwork for when a kid becomes an adolescent, they've got a little bit more resistance, they've got a little bit more of an urge to get away, that they're going to also be a little bit more open to hearing what you say. So I think it really does reach back to when kids are little, and so I think it's not just a matter of catching parents when they are the parents of adolescents, but catching parents when their kids are younger and saying, look, you can put into place a groundwork for effective communication if you start now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very wise advice. That makes a lot of sense. One thing, Scott, you said that I want to explore more deeply is that there's a lot of information out there for teens, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. Aaron mentioned at the top that every teen comes into a slightly different world, and they're ready to adapt to that world. And one part of this generation's world is that there's so much pornography out there. There's some concerns about a hookup culture where sex is supposedly viewed as more casual. What are some more of the facts about hookups and pornography, and how can we understand them as parents?
Aaron, you want to go there?
I'll try. This is such a delicate topic. This is a great example of what Scott was saying. We're not there yet with the brain science to really know what the changes in the brain during adolescence, how they influence this part of it. What's concerning to both of us is the fact that in the modern world, teens have to make decisions rapid fire at a time when it can be challenging for them to make good choices and control their urges. Nowadays, with such easy access to things like pornography or drugs, including alcohol, it's not like you just have to make the choice once a week. I'm not going to go somewhere where I might be exposed to pornography. Because now if you have a cell phone or you're on a computer, it's there if you want it. So I think it requires quite a bit more of a concerted effort on the part of teens to avoid some of these pitfalls because of how easy they are to access. And that also makes the job harder for parents because it means we have to have conversations with our kids quite often about the same subjects. You don't just have one sex talk or one talk about alcohol. It's something we have to do regularly because as kids change and their circles of friends change and these things create new opportunities for parents to discuss the risks with teens. So it is a very different world. I just don't know where we are right now in terms of brain science that we could bring to bear on this issue.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, one interesting thing that happens, though, when there's a vacuum of credible information, say in this case, still a lot of research to be done on the brain effects of pornography, for example, is that there's still people out there sort of claiming expertise and making bold claims about pornography doing terrible things to our generation or not. So it's wise of you to point out that there's lack of information, but it's also worth emphasizing that doesn't mean there aren't people out there who are claiming they've got it all figured out.
Quite. I mean, yes, there will always be those people, even within the scientific community. There are going to be people who want to jump to conclusions because to them the evidence seems so compelling. The thing about evidence is that it changes. I mean, science is really a process by which you collect as much data as you can. You see what it tends to show you, because the story, it's very rare that you find something that where every time somebody does a study, the findings support a conclusion you've drawn up front. You mentioned video games and violence. I mean, it's a great example. I mean, it sure does make sense on the surface that playing a violent video game has to be bad for a kid. But not all the research tells us that, and certainly even the research that tells us it's bad doesn't tell us that it's going to ruin a kid for life. I mean, the metaphor I like to use is about our uncertainty here is, if it were the case that playing violent video games turned kids violent, then you would expect to see a rash of violence in the suburbs at Christmas time after kids get game consoles and games, and you just don't see that. So these things are really nuanced, and we're just not there yet. Even with something like video games to draw strong conclusions about what it means for kids.
Yeah, and I think, too, that when it comes to both violence in video games or violence portrayals in general and pornography probably as well, while those things don't sort of induce the bad behavior that's going on the screen, they do tend to desensitize kids to the impact of violence, for example, make them less sensitive to it, less appalled by it, less frightened by it, which, has both good and bad sides to it. But I think what that means is that there, it's not that there aren't effects. It's that, they're not necessarily what you would assume that they would be.
Mm-hmm.
And so we take a position in the book in general, and there's a chapter in there on social networks and all of that and how that might affect brain function and how adolescents might experience that differently than adults. And a general point that we make is that, whenever you study something and you are going to put a treatment into place, you have to entertain the possibility that it's going to go one way or the other. Right, that's called a two-tailed test. Right, you got to, you got to be open to the possibility that it might improve what you're measuring, or it might diminish what you're measuring. So, video games in some ways, and social networking in some ways, have been shown to be very good for teens, particularly teens, with social anxiety disorder and so forth, kids that aren't as comfortable necessarily to go out into the face-to-face world as readily. Some studies have shown that social media can be extremely valuable for kids like that. So it's not a simple one-sided thing, even though parents and educators, tend to always worry about something, right? So parents of every generation have found something to worry about rotting their kids' brain, right? So these days it's social networking and so forth, and generations past it was other things. We have to be open to the possibility that these things can cut both ways.
Well said. Well said. Yes, I agree. Yeah, Elvis's pelvis didn't end up killing anybody, despite fears.
Right, or comic books, for that matter.
Or comic books, right.
Right, I like to say, if you just follow it back, and this generation, it's social media. In my generation, it was, television. In my parents' generation, it was a telephone. You go back to people dwelling in caves, and they were probably complaining about hieroglyphics. So, it's every generation of parents finds something to worry about, and they should, because there's plenty to worry about, but it doesn't mean that everything out there is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Good point. Well, let's move on to something that you're both very well-versed in, and that definitely has a bad side, which is alcohol. alcohol is and teenage years is a tricky mix. I think there's just a gap of education for the general public about alcohol's effects. What misconceptions do people in general have about alcohol and about, you know, how dangerous it is or how much is enough?
Well, I mean, Aaron is at the National Institute on Alcoholism, and he's, you know, he's really steeped in this, so I'll turn it to him. But I think that really most people in general, they don't really understand the effects of alcohol very well. They don't understand, you know, how much alcohol it takes to, you know, to make them feel subjectively buzzed, and what that's doing to some of the underlying brain processes that subserve, say, learning and memory and other cognitive functions. So you can impair those functions at doses well below what it takes to really make you feel high. So I think there's sort of broad lack of information, lack of accurate information out there about alcohol for teens and adults, and the fact that alcohol is in some ways more potent in the teen brain than in the adult brain, and in some ways less potent, that's something that almost nobody thinks about. So with that broad statement, I think I'll go ahead and see what Aaron would like to chime in on that.
Well, that's perfect. Thank you for, you gave me a lot to talk about. And I concur with Scott. I think that, you know, alcohol is one of these things that's been part of the fabric of our culture here, for sure, since its inception. We don't tend to think of it even as a drug still, because it's so ubiquitous. But what we're learning in science is that it is, it's an incredibly powerful drug that has mostly negative effects. We like to kid ourselves, I think, and think that it's somehow can be really healthy for us, and it can be in to some small degree. There's some evidence that a drink or two a day can be beneficial for your cardiovascular health. It acts as a good, thins the blood, reduces the risk of stroke. But only if you have a small amount, as Scott likes to say, or often says, if you take it like medicine. If you're not drinking it to catch a buzz or, celebrate getting off work every day, you take it like medicine. Like, okay, having my glass of wine. I like it, but it's sort of like medicine. In that sense, it can be beneficial. It can be beneficial for adults in that it can be a social lubricant. It can promote relaxation in small amounts. But what we're learning is that even at that one or two drink a day level, the risk of cancer goes up steeply, particularly for females. And then, of course, beyond that, the risk of injury and other diseases goes up too. It's something that's best used in moderation. We define that here as one drink a day, no more than one drink a day for a female, no more than two a day for a male. Once you cross those levels, then the risks increase. It's a different story for teens. Let me just tell you why. There are a couple brain areas here that are worth mentioning. Alcohol is a drug, and in essence, we call it a drug because if you throw it in a barrel with all the other things we call drugs, even if they're totally different molecularly, very different pharmacologically in terms of their effects in the brain, they all share one thing in common, and that's that they activate the reward system. There's a part of the brain, set of parts of the brain that help us learn to repeat behaviors that are presumably good for our survival by giving us a little pat on the back. You're really thirsty, you drink a glass of water, you get that feeling. That makes you want to drink water again when you're thirsty. Drugs do that by tricking you into thinking you just did something good. You do the drug, it feels good, the brain goes, that must have been important, let's return. Well, we adults like that. We also like the effect of suppression of the amygdala, which is an area that plays a role in anxiety and fear. So it helps us feel, you come home from work and you have a glass of wine and you go, oh, I feel a little bit of pleasure and I feel less emotional pain. For teens, the issue here is the reward system seems to be particularly responsive in that if you find something that activates it, it makes you feel really alive. I'm being simplistic here, but this is part of what's going on. And so if you add a drug like alcohol, the brain can easily be tricked into wanting to repeat the behavior, even if it's ultimately negative. Teens don't need to have the amygdala suppressed. Even though it's a time of high anxiety, it's also a time of high risk-taking already. Suppressing the amygdala increases the odds of taking risks. You don't want to suppress your frontal lobes. You know, it's a different world for teens. Teens tend to drink less often than adults, but much more heavily when they do. Oh, let me just throw out one more thing since I've been rambling on this long already. One thing that you asked, what do people not know? One thing that parents, I think, generally don't know, because Scott and I didn't know it until the science came out, it's not accurate to assume that cultures that let their kids drink at young ages have lower levels of problems with alcohol in their kids. In fact, it turns out it's the opposite. If you look at levels of binge drinking, which is having five or more drinks at a time, across Europe, compared to the United States, teens in the U.S. drink less than teens in every European country that's been studied. And we have a higher drinking age. So it's not the case that lowering the drinking age would help us with this issue of underage drinking. In fact, data from Europe tells us the opposite. Further, if you look at parents who let their kids drink at home, whether it's in the Netherlands, the United States, or Australia, that's where the work has been done, those teens tend to drink more heavily outside of the home. So for parents, it's just a cautionary word about, you know, it may seem logical to teach your kid how to drink, but don't think that that means they're going to take your one serving lesson with them into the world. You know, statistically, they tend to drink more heavily. Okay, that's what I got.
Well, that's really interesting. And let's dwell on that last point a little more. I was just reflecting as I was preparing for this interview that I took Alcohol EDU, and it's really cool to speak to the people who are the architects of it and people who are collecting the research for it. So I remember the page or the section that was talking about the legal drinking age and was very surprised at your data, just because, especially when you're a teenager, but you hear it from adults a lot, you've probably heard it at dinner parties, the preponderance of comments you hear about the drinking age in the U.S. is that, oh, it's sort of high, or, oh, if only we were like the Europeans, then kids wouldn't binge so much and overdo it when they're finally free. I don't know if you remember the data offhand, but if you just look at binge drinking and you're comparing college-age kids in the U.S. and European countries, is it about the same or more in Europe or more in the U.S.?
With college-age kids? I'm actually not sure about college-age kids. I'm not sure that we have those data. But when it's high school kids, this looked at 15 to 16-year-olds was the study that was commissioned by the European Union. Yeah, I mean, for 15 to 16-year-olds, it's about 20% of our kids binge a month. And then the next closest is France. It's 28%. And then it just goes up from there. Turkey's the only country we out-binge because they're largely, you know, Islamic. But college to college, I'm not sure.
I think one reason we're not sure about that is that the work really hasn't been done, and so this question that you're getting at there, Jose, is that you know, is there something about when a kid leaves home and all of a sudden the restraints are gone, they're just going to go completely crazy if they've been unable to drink up to the time they leave home, and then you've got this 18 to 21 period where you sort of uncap this reservoir of drinking frustration that the kids have felt when they go off to college. And the truth is, we just don't know the answer to that question yet. I think it's a reasonable hypothesis, you know, to think that there may be something to that. I also think it's a reasonable hypothesis that in some ways and to some degree, societies that treat alcohol more like a food event than a drug event may in some ways inoculate kids against dangerous types of drink. And because remember, it's not just whether or not a kid drinks outside the home, it's how they drink outside the home. If a kid learns, you know, if a kid drinks moderately in both places, that's fine. You know, what you don't want is this, you know, very dangerous, harmful pattern of drinking. So with college-age kids, I think Aaron's right. We don't know that answer. The studies haven't been done. And I think until they are, it's important to keep an open mind about what the results might be.
Mm-hmm.
Fair point. I also want to maybe wrap up this alcohol discussion by circling back to this idea that adults kid themselves about potential benefits of or medicinal effects of alcohol. There was this headline-grabbing study that I know the science writer Jonah Lehrer wrote about before being disgraced. It was supposedly a study showing a correlation between how long someone lived, their life expectancy, and the amount of drinking that they did on a regular basis. And so supposedly people who were moderate or even heavy drinkers on average lived longer than people who were completely abstinent. And of course, it was only correlational, but it started some buzz about, well, maybe the social lubricant effects help stave off loneliness, which stave off cortisol, which increase people's life expectancy, and blah, 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 blah. So I'm asking you to speculate here, but Aaron, in particular, have you encountered that study before and responded to it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's a well-known, what you just described. I mean, I don't know if it's, there may be more than one study, but that's a well-known finding, that you get sort of this J-shaped curve of mortality, basically. If you look at mortality rates in a given year, they are lower for moderate drinkers. And in fact, in those, the study that I'm aware of, again, it's a big set of data, you had to get up to about four or five drinks a day before your mortality rate started to equal that of the abstainers. And yeah, there's been all kinds of speculation about why that might be. You can't diminish the importance of the socialization that happens among adults when they drink. I mean, I do think there's some real value in that. I'm sure there's real value in it if people don't drink. It's having friends predicts living longer if you have cancer. I mean, all of these various things. Clearly, we're a social animal, and it's important for our well-being, and alcohol can be a part of that. But what people often miss is that in that group of people who don't drink are also people who are about to die. You know, so people who have cancer and are just about to die, they're not drinking. So you know, it's an artificial. It's just not what you think. You know, it's more complicated than just how much alcohol these people are having. Now, you know, and let me just throw this out there. Particularly with regard to teens, it's not so much and Scott alluded to this, it's not so much the risks of long-term drinking that we're most concerned about, but there is evidence that long-term drinking in teens reduces cognitive function and alters brain development, but at least they're still alive. You know, the big concern is what happens when someone drinks once and they make bad choices. You know, you decide that it isn't a bad idea to try to jump off a roof into a swimming pool. You know, that it isn't a bad idea to try to drive. When you combine that with the fact that teens are wired in such a way that, you know, if you put a teenager, talking about driving, you put a teenager in an imager, MRI, and you do functional imaging while they do a driving task, and they have to take some risks if they want to win. You put a teen in there, they actually do just fine. They look like adults. Now, it's not a real-world test, but it's a simulated driving experience where they have to take risks. They do like adults do, but when you put a friend in the room, even in the back of the room, they can't even see the friend. The friend is just there. Two things happen. One is the reward system lights up, and two is they start taking all kinds of crazy risks. Teens are just wired differently than we are. Risk is very rewarding. While for adults, you might expect this to be the case, risk is less rewarding because we're supposed to, you know, keep it all together and protect our families and take care of ourselves. It's not a time to be jumping off roofs into swimming pools when you're 35 and you've got kids. So when we're teens, when you add alcohol to a teen brain, you're going to get a different set of outcomes behaviorally, and they raise red flags about acute injury. Alcohol is the number one contributor to the three leading causes of death for teens: injury, homicide, and suicide. Mm. These are all injury-related deaths. It's different. Teens and adults are not the same with regard to alcohol. Our job, I think, is to try to get teens through the teen years without drinking, or drinking as little as we can possibly, so that once they become, they hit the late teens, early 20s, if they want to start drinking moderately, they can enjoy that for the next 60 years.
Right, right. So you're both parents. We talked about parenting, about sex to teens. How have you approached alcohol with your kids? Scott, for example, you're through it. How did that work out?
You know, it worked out pretty well. I had one child who didn't drink at all, literally, until she was 21. My middle child, who's a boy, drank some, during his high school years with his friends. But I, was very pleased to note that, that they didn't do it excessively, and they always actually built in designated drivers and all sorts of safeguards to keep anybody from getting hurt or in trouble. And my third child is a non-drinker too. So two out of the three of them weren't really interested, and the one that was pretty rational about the whole thing. And so so I didn't have a lot of work to do. Of course, I started talking to them about alcohol when they were about three. Right, and just in terms of my wife and I would have a glass of wine with dinner, and they'd want to know about that, and then it's just a topic of conversation around my house the way it isn't around most people's houses. But part of I think the advantage of this information that we convey in the book about the adolescent brain is that can open the door to those conversations which otherwise might be more awkward to open up. And so the advantage my kids had is they had access to a lot of information, and it was conveyed in just a matter-of-fact, what'd you do at work today, Dad, way. And I think to the extent that other parents who happen not to work in the alcohol research field can strip out some of the affect and some of the judgment and some of the authoritarianism associated with those conversations and supplant those with information for its own sake, then I think those conversations can be had just as effectively by any parent as I was able to have them with my kids.
Right. Well, I'm glad that worked out for you, and it sounds like once again you've laid a path of wisdom for Aaron to follow. So good. It's a good parting note because our time is up. But thank you both so much for coming on. I'm going to just quickly take us out by saying that we've been speaking with Dr. Scott Swartzwelder and Dr. Aaron White. They're the authors of What Are They Thinking? The Straight Facts About the Risk-Taking, Social Networking, Still Developing Teen Brain. This is Psych Talk on WCOM, and Scott and Aaron, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening.